All right, good evening, everybody. We're going to be looking at Hebrews chapter 7. And this has always been, for me personally, one of the harder chapters in Hebrews to teach. I think we can understand what's going on in the chapter, but to make, I think, good, really helpful applications, I'll want your guys' feedback on that as we go through this. Jake Gibson's going to open us up in a word of prayer, though, so we can go ahead and do that now. All right, as we get into this evening, can anybody remind us again, what is it that the audience is going through to whom this writer is writing this letter? Yeah, persecution. I don't have it on the PowerPoint tonight, but can anybody tell me what chapter in Hebrews tells us what it is that they're going through? Yeah, chapter 10. It's not until we get to chapter 10, verses 32 to 34, where the writer finally says that these are the things that you guys have been going through. Your property's been seized. You're being publicly exposed to affliction and stuff like that. And so you've become like the laughingstock of those around you. Some of them have been put in prison. None of them, at least according to chapter 12, verse 4, have been martyred yet. And so things could be worse, I guess, in some of those ways. But the reason that the writer is writing to these people, he says it in chapter 13. What does he say he's trying to do in this letter to this audience? Yeah, he's trying to encourage them. He's writing them what he says is a brief letter or a brief word of exhortation, which, again, the book takes 45 minutes to read, and according to him, that's pretty brief. And so the way that he's doing that is, the way that he's trying to encourage the audience throughout all of this is showing that Jesus is superior to the old covenant system of the angels who gave the law, who were involved in one way or another of giving the law. He's greater than Moses. He's greater than the priests. This is that third section down there, if I can get this thing to work. Right here, this is where we are right now, that Jesus's priesthood is superior to the one in the Old Testament, not only Melchizedek's, well, not only Levi's, but also Melchizedek, and that's what we're going to look at tonight, which then will launch us in, starting Sunday morning, chapters 8, 9, and 10 on how Jesus brings a better sacrifice. And he's already been bringing up hints of that as we've been going through. We're going to see some of those things in this chapter tonight. But if we're studying this book the right way, I think we're supposed to leave every class being encouraged to stay strong in serving the Lord, despite what circumstances might throw our way. And that's what the writer's trying to do as he's bringing all of this up. All right. Any comments or questions about that, just by way of introduction to the book? Again, an overly simplified outline of the book, chapters 1 through 10, is dealing a lot with doctrine. Like, here's the deep things to think about that shows Jesus is greater. And then 11 through 13, loosely, is trying to get the audience to be disciplined in light of all of this great information that they've been given. And so tonight, he's going to talk to them about Jesus being in the same priesthood, in the same order as Melchizedek. And I want to begin just by showing this. Where is it in the Bible that Melchizedek is mentioned? There's two times in the Old Testament that he's mentioned, and then there's two places in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 5 and Hebrews chapter 7. But does anybody know in the Old Testament, where's the first place that Melchizedek is mentioned? Yeah, Genesis chapter 14. So in Genesis chapter 14, you've got Abraham, and he goes and rescues his nephew Lot, and on the way back, he runs into Melchizedek, and there's that interesting story about him bringing bread and wine and all of these things to Abraham, and then Abraham is blessed by him, and he gives him a tithe and everything like that. All right, so where's the second time in the Old Testament that Melchizedek is mentioned? Psalms. All right, so in between Genesis 14 and Psalm 110 is about 1,000 years, roughly, right around there. And then you've got Psalm 110, and this is the second time that he's mentioned, and it's been 1,000 years, and the only thing we've known about him is just this really small section in the book of Genesis. And then the writer of Psalms, David, is bringing this up and saying that there's going to be another priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, we'll talk about what that means in just a moment. But then another 1,000 years passes, and then we've got this all being connected in the book of Hebrews, chapters 5 and 7. And this is one of those kinds of things that there's so little said about this guy in the Old Testament. Then for the writer of Hebrews, I would wonder, if you were a Jewish Christian, this would have been maybe one of those parts of the Old Testament that you would have read and gone, well, that's really interesting. I don't know why Abraham ran into this guy. I don't know why Abraham gave this guy a tithe. I don't know who he is, where he came from, or anything. And then we also have this psalm that says that there's going to be this Messiah or this Christ that's going to be like that guy. And now here, finally, over the course of these thousands of years, these things are being put together for these people. So that's what we're going to look at tonight. I will remind us that in chapter 5, verse 11, this is the thing that the writer wanted to expand on at that point. And then he said, but this is hard for you guys to understand because you're dull of hearing. In other words, you've become lazy Bible students. And I guess I'll say this as maybe an encouragement or maybe a minor rebuke or something like that. I don't know what the right word would be for that. But if this stuff is really hard for us to understand and grapple with, the writer of Hebrews at least says that could be because we've become dull of hearing. So, the way that we'll outline what we're going to look at tonight is chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, he's going to argue that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. Now, that's interesting because all throughout the book of Hebrews, the writer's been showing that Jesus is greater than everything. But he's going to start out this section by saying that Melchizedek is the one that's greater than Abraham. And the reason that that's going to matter is because Jesus is like Melchizedek, and he's even greater than Melchizedek. So that's where he's going to go with that. Verses 11 through 19, he's going to show that Jesus' priesthood is in the same order as Melchizedek, and what the implications for the old law is. And then finally, verses 20 through 28, he's going to show the benefits of this superior priesthood that Jesus is bringing, as it's in the same order as Melchizedek. All right, does that make sense, where we're going with this? Any comments or questions or anything about that before we jump into the text? All right. Jason, do you want to read chapter 7, verses 1 through 10?
For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. Now consider how great this man was, to whom even the patriarch Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils. And indeed, those who are of the sons of Levi, who receive the priesthood, have a commandment to receive tithes from the people according to the law. That is, from their brethren, though they have come from the loins of Abraham. But he whose genealogy is not derived from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Now beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better. Here mortal men receive tithes, but there he receives them, of whom it is witness that he lives. Even Levi, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, so to speak, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him.
All right, as the writer brings up Melchizedek here, I think we can start out with this question. Who is Melchizedek? What does he say about him here? And he begins by defining what his name means. And what does his name mean? King of Peace. Melchizedek mean... was it King of Peace or King of Righteousness? Oh, I did that wrong then. Yeah, so his name means King of Peace. He's the King of Salem, which means peace. But his name... So his name means King of Righteousness. Wait, did I get that right? Yeah, I got it right. Never mind. I'm right. I should never question myself. Isaiah chapter 9 has a prophecy about how the Messiah was going to be the king of righteousness and stuff like that. And so here's this guy, by translation of his name, he's the king of righteousness. Now, what roles did he have? What positions of authority did he have in this text? And we also see this in Genesis chapter 14. Yeah, he's priest and king. So he's king of Salem, and the word Salem means peace, like when the Jews would say shalom. That's a way of saying peace and greetings to each other and stuff like that. That was the early name for Jerusalem. And so here's a guy that's reigning as the king, king of righteousness, and he's in the city of peace. He's also a priest of God. He's not just a priest, period. He's a priest of God. And by the way, I think this is interesting. Up to this point in Genesis chapter 14, God is communicating with Abraham. And maybe you would start to think that God is only going to be working through Abraham and only working through his people. And these are the only people that he's going to have any kind of relationship with. But then we've got this guy in this city that we haven't really been exposed to this point. And you've got a priest of God in this Gentile sort of city. And so God is involved in other ways in these other places. But this guy is combining both priest and king. And in the Old Testament, we've talked about this a little bit before, when there were kings who tried to act like priests, like Saul offering a sacrifice, or King Uzziah. Do you remember what happened to Uzziah's forehead in 2 Chronicles 26 when he goes into the temple? Yeah, his forehead becomes leprous, and so that's a very clear sign that you don't belong here anymore. And so here's a guy that before the law is ever given, he's combining these two roles that the law of Moses separates. And then he sort of vanishes from the scene, but there's a couple more things to say about him here. What else is Hebrews saying about him that's maybe curious to you or seems sort of mysterious about him? What was that? Yeah, no beginning or end. He's without genealogy. There's no record of his birth or his death. I think some people have taken what the writer here is saying is that he really, like, he was Jesus in the Old Testament, kind of manifesting himself in that person. I think the idea is there was no record of his birth or his death. And in the book of Genesis, are there lots of genealogies? So here's a guy that shows up on the scene, and there's nothing said about his genealogy. Now, why would this matter, do you think, for the writer of Hebrews, as he's going to compare it to the Levitical priesthood? If you wanted to be a Levitical priest, what really mattered? What did you have to prove about yourself? Your genealogy. And if you couldn't prove your genealogy, there's stories like that in Ezra and Nehemiah where people that couldn't prove their genealogy, they can't really serve as priests. And so this matters for them, but for Melchizedek, there's no way of tracing, okay, Melchizedek's son was the same way that he was, and he was, no, you can't really tell that. We don't know anything else about him. And so he kind of shows up in a mysterious sort of way. All right, so that's who Melchizedek is. Any comments or questions that or anything you guys want to add to that before we see how he's greater than Abraham? Yeah, Jason? Yeah, he remains a priest forever. Jesus is going to be in the same order as Melchizedek in the sense that, like, he just kind of shows up and there's nothing said about afterwards. And so he's kind of mysteriously just a forever priest. And Jesus is going to be that way in a greater way, I think. All right. Notice then, what's the evidence in this text? And there's two main things that he brings up. How do we know in this text that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham? Yeah. He blesses Abraham, which means that the text says that the lesser is the one that's blessed by the greater. And so for Melchizedek to bless Abraham means that he's the one that's greater than Abraham. All right, what's the other piece of evidence that he's greater than Abraham? Yeah, he gives him the tithe. And what kind of argument does he bring up from this? Okay, so if Abraham gives a tithe to Melchizedek, what does that mean about the priesthood that eventually comes from the loins of Abraham? Yeah. Yeah, if Abraham is the one that's sort of embodying the nation, the text says that he's the patriarch of the people, which means that he's representing the nation is sort of embodied in him. And so what he does and the people that he submits to or this person that he submits to, that means everybody that comes from Abraham is likewise inferior, just as Abraham their forefather was. Right. Yeah, that's true. Good point. That's a good point. And so can you imagine, like, the Jews who would study the Bible, the Torah together and stuff like that, to them, Abraham was, like, the biggest deal, and for a lot of obvious reasons. How often do you think they would really talk about how great Melchizedek really was, though? He just is, like, kind of a blip on the radar. I don't imagine that they would have given a ton of attention. Now, I haven't read all of the Jewish writings. I don't even know if the Jews really wrote much about this. Does anybody happen to know that? If in the Jewish extra-biblical writings, if they really mention this guy very much? Yeah, that's something that I want to find out. Because I'm not aware that they bring him up very much. All right, so here's I think, the groundwork that the writer of Hebrews is doing here. Melchizedek is a type of Christ. He's a shadow of Christ. And if the type is greater than the reality of Abraham, how much more is the reality of the type, if any of this is making sense, going to be greater than Abraham? Does that make sense? Think about how Melchizedek is already foreshadowing Jesus. Jesus is the King of Righteousness. Jesus is the King of Peace. He's the one that combines priest and king in one role. And this was somebody who historically was literally a real person in Genesis chapter 14. He's a shadow of Christ. But if that shadow is greater than Abraham, then Jesus must be really great, is where he's going with this. All right. Anything else you guys want to comment on before we look at the next section then? All right, Jason, do you want to read 11 through 19?
Therefore, if perfection were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called? Forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness. For the law made nothing perfect. On the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God.
All right, you notice how in verse 11 and in verse 19, he's going to bookend these verses with a similar word, or there's the same word in both verses, and that's perfection or perfect. That in verse 11, perfection was not attainable through the Levitical priesthood, and then in verse 19, the law made nothing perfect. So notice what he's saying here. The priesthood under the Old Covenant couldn't make people perfect, and neither could the law. Now, he's not just talking about one and neglecting the other. Both of them are being under the discussion here. And so this maybe helps us understand some things about what he's doing here. The law and the Levitical priesthood were bound together. The law was the thing that told people how the priesthood was going to function and what they were going to do and who could be a priest and everything like that. The law and the priesthood were intricately connected with each other. And so what the writer of Hebrews is saying here is that if there's going to be a new priesthood, that means that the law has to change as well. That's where he's going with this. But start out with this idea here, and the text brings up some of this. What were the requirements to be a Levitical priest? We already talked about it a little bit, but let's talk about it a little bit more here. What qualified you to be a Levitical priest? That you're from the tribe of Levi. So you had to be a bodily descendant. Which means, by the way, this was pretty easy. Like, if you were in the lineage, it was pretty easy for you to get that check mark. That means that you could have ungodly yet qualified priests under the Old Covenant law. So, for example, do you remember Eli and his sons, Annas and Caiaphas? Guys that were not acting like the high priest that they were supposed to be, but they were still qualified. And so the law allowed that sort of thing if they technically were meeting those requirements. And so here he's going to contrast it with Jesus' priesthood. So how does he contrast Jesus' priesthood with the Levitical priesthood in this text? Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah, and the end of this chapter is really going to hammer that home about Jesus' perfect character and everything like that. So, all right. So what do you guys see as being some of the contrasts between the priesthoods? Yeah, Jason? Okay, good, good. Jesus' life is indestructible. The priest, and we're going to say more about this in a little bit, but the priest would die, and that's what would stop them from serving. Steve? Okay, good. And so you got the tribe of Levi versus Jesus is not part of the tribe of Levi. Jesus is from the tribe of Judah. All right, this is a little Bible trivia. In 1 Kings, when the tribes split into the northern and the southern kingdom, the kings in the northern kingdom, what tribes were they from? Not in the north. They were kind of all over the place. Like, they had lots of different dynasties. All of the kings from the south were from what tribe? All of them were in the lineage of David. And so for Jesus to be from the tribe of Judah, this is the tribe that in the Old Testament is associated with kings, at least in the southern kingdom. And so Jesus is from more of the kingly tribe. Genesis 48 and 49 has got some prophecies about Judah being that kind of having that role as well. And so what the writer of Hebrews is saying here is if Jesus is from the tribe of Judah, well, the Old Testament law doesn't speak about non-Levites being priests. And so if Jesus is declared to be the priest, well, that goes against the law, doesn't it? And so, by the way, as maybe a side point, he says that the law spoke nothing about having a non-Levite being a priest. And this is a verse that a lot of people have used, verse 14, to show that if the law says nothing about it, that means that we can't take action on it. And so maybe there's some points to be made about that. But the point that he's making in context is that if Jesus is indeed a priest and he's been declared a priest, but he's not from the tribe of Levi, that means that a whole new system has to be put in place in order for that to actually be true. Does that make sense? All right, any comments or questions about that as we go through this? This is, again, harder stuff for me to know how to explain in a super helpful way, I think. So if anybody wants to clarify anything, you can. Steve? Maybe that would have something to do with it. Anybody have any thoughts they want to expand on with that? Yeah, Doug? Okay. All right. All right, well, notice here then that what he's saying, how he bookends this section, is that Jesus is bringing something better. The old ways, the law and the old priesthood, couldn't bring anybody to perfection. We noted how the text begins and ends that way. So Jesus is a new priest, but if the law couldn't bring perfection either, you need to have a new king that brings a new law. And that's why if the priesthood and the law goes together, Jesus is going to be the perfect new lawgiver, and he's going to be the perfect new priest, which is why these roles have to be combined in him for him to bring the things that have been prophesied about him. But what does it mean, do you think, that the law and the priesthood couldn't bring anybody to perfection? Okay, so like the blood of bulls and goats couldn't forgive anybody, and they had to keep making the sacrifices over and over again. So there's no permanent solving of the problem, maybe. What else would you guys say about how the law and the priesthood of the Old Covenant couldn't make anybody perfect? Yeah, what does that mean that it was weak and useless? Okay, maybe it wasn't designed to be perfect, maybe because it was all looking forward to something greater. What are you going to say? Okay, good. Okay. Yeah, so the priests under the Old Covenant, they had to stop, offer sacrifices for their own sins. Jesus didn't have to do that, so you've got a better priest and everything like that. So that'd be one of the reasons why the very people that are making these sacrifices for you are imperfect, which would mean that maybe part of the system has got some ways of needing to be perfected. Yeah. Yeah, good, good. Well, I thought, though, like in Romans, Paul, when he talks about the purpose of the law and everything, he even asks the question, does that mean that the law is like a bad thing? And he says, no. So how can the writer of Hebrews say that it was weak and useless? But then there's other passages like in Galatians and other in Romans 7 that say that there was actually a lot of use to it, too. Jason? Right. Or we could say it this way, that when God had the Israelites make the tabernacle, why did he have them make it? So that he could dwell with them. All right, so what do you have to do to draw near to him? Well, sacrifices have to be made. For him to make the tabernacle and have the priesthood was so that the people could draw near, but the problem was that none of the sacrifices ever permanently accomplished it. That's why they had to do it all the time. And so under what Jesus has done, has he offered a way that's permanently open now? And it creates greater intimacy than we could have had before. Yeah, so that I think that's the idea. But Mason? Yeah, that's good. Doug, were you going to say something? Right. And I think if you go to an MRI and the MRI tells you that you tore your meniscus in your knee, or your ACL or something, can that same MRI heal the problem? No, all it can do is it can tell you that you have this problem. But it's weak and it's useless. The MRI machine is weak and it's useless so far as it is its ability to be able to fix the problem. It can tell you what the problem is, though. Then you need something else to actually do the surgery. And so this is maybe a helpful analogy to think about. Where is the old law valuable? At least according to Galatians chapter 3, it's valuable in the sense that it exposes our sin, and it's kind of like the MRI machine that helps us see what's wrong with us. But it's weak and useless so as to remove the cancer that we have. And then Jesus comes and he's able to be the perfect high priest who's able to do that after the order of Melchizedek, combining these things that needed to be combined for us to have this perfection that we all need and stuff like that. So maybe that helps with some of that. I thought I saw another hand, though. Maybe I didn't. Yeah, over here. Right. Right. Yeah, very good. And maybe say this too about Psalm 110. It's the most quoted Old Testament passage in the New Testament. And that passage says that there's going to be a new priest king after the order of Melchizedek. The old law, the Jewish writings themselves are indicating by that there is going to be a change of everything in what it says there. All right, so that's Jesus' priesthood being after the order of Melchizedek. He's a priest king. He's forever. We'll talk about that now in verses 20 through 28. So, Jason, do you want to read the last few verses here?
And inasmuch as he was not made priest without an oath, for they have become priests without an oath, but he with an oath by him who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." By so much more, Jesus has become a surety of a better covenant. Also, there were many priests, because they were prevented by death from continuing. But he, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily as those high priests to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints as high priest men who have weakness, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints the Son who has been perfected forever.
All right. You see how he, throughout this section, he's kind of weaving together how Jesus is after the order of Melchizedek, but he's also sort of like the Levitical priests, but greater than them. So he's kind of putting all of this together. Priests are mediators, and the Levites were mediators. But there was one great one that was greater than all of that, and that was Melchizedek. So Jesus is doing the same kind of work that a priest would do, but it's after the order of the one that's greater. But notice what he says here are, you can organize this probably in several different ways, but what are the benefits of Jesus' priesthood being in the order of Melchizedek? Notice, first of all, that this is assured with an oath that Jesus is this priest. And you see that in verses 20 through 22. The Levitical priests were not given divine oaths. In fact, there's times in 1 Samuel 2, and then you link that with 1 Kings 2, where there's priests that had their priesthood, and it could be revoked from them. And so for Jesus to be the priest after the order of Melchizedek and what Psalm 110 is saying about him, it's a divine oath that's placing him into that position. And the text says that God will not change his mind about it. And so I think the oath is Psalm 110 and what that says about what he's going to do. So that's, I think, the first benefit that we see there. But there's a second one, is that Jesus' priesthood, I think, is therefore permanent. We talked about this when we went through chapter 5. But the Levitical priests, their ability to stay in office or whatever, they could only reign as long as they were alive. And so we mentioned this statistic last time, that in the Old Covenant period, there were 83 priests over the course of about 1,700 years. And some people say that there was 84, so whatever. But with Jesus, it's been over like 2,000 years, and we've had one priest. And so you see the permanency of Jesus' priesthood through this, which is interesting. If you imagine being a Jew living under the Old Covenant system where you had priests that you relied on to help you get close to God, well, what if them was really sick? What if one of them was really sick on the Day of Atonement or something? Like, your access to God depended on a mortal person under the old law, in the system that God created. And sometimes the reason that some of them died, like Nadab and Abihu, was because they can make their own mistakes as well. So you think about living under that system, how much sense of security could you have all the time? Not a ton. Because there was a lot riding on that guy that could make his own mistakes and maybe wasn't perfect and all of that different kind of thing. But then you've got Jesus, who in this text ever lives to make intercession for us. So on the cross, I read this, I like this. He gave himself for us on the cross, but now he gives himself to us as he's in heaven interceding for us all the time. I think that's a cool way of putting that. I've been talking for a little bit, so any comments or questions about any of this? All right. I think it's helpful to think about how he's ever living to make intercession for us, because I think we always need help, which means that he's always available to give help in our time of need, like chapter 4 talked about in Hebrews. And so that's one of the benefits of that. Verse 16 said that Jesus' life was indestructible. I don't know of anything that's indestructible. I remember going camping, and there was like these, when I was in Boy Scouts, and there was big like things that looked like refrigerators that were called like bear boxes, where bears apparently couldn't get into it, and it was an indestructible box that a bear couldn't take the food from. And we always had some sense of like security knowing that your food was in there, because you know that the bears can't get it. If you're under the Old Testament law, you don't have security. But with Jesus, knowing that his life is indestructible and he's the one that's in heaven making intercession for you, that gives you a lot more security than you would have had. All right, so anything you guys want to say up to that point about this? Doug? Okay. Anything else? All right. Notice then Jesus' superior character in verses 26 through 28. The way that Jesus' character is described here, there's a lot of things that are said about him, but several of the things that it says, that he's holy, innocent, and unstained. That sounds a lot like the kind of language that's used for the animal sacrifices in the Old Testament. And Jesus is perfectly unblemished. He is holy. He's the one that's unstained. What does it say about his relationship to sinners? What verse is it? Yes, separated from sinners. Isn't that interesting that it says that he's separated from sinners, but he's also the one that's mediating for us? He's separated from sinners in the sense that he doesn't share in sin. He's obviously not separated from us in the sense that he's neglecting us in any way. But he's not like us in our sin, is I think the point of that. Yeah, that's good. So you see how Jesus is fulfilling all of that kind of language. And because of this, he was qualified to actually offer up himself, unlike the Levitical priests who had to offer an animal first for their own sins, and then they could offer the sacrifice for the other people. Jesus can go straight and make his own sacrifice on behalf of us. And so this means, by the way, that the sacrifice that he made was entirely for our benefit. He didn't need to make any sacrifices for himself. He was perfect. The fact that he offered up himself means that he did this solely for us, and obviously for God's glory and all of that sort of thing. But I think we have to see the degree to which he loves us in all of this as well. All right. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah, Jason. Okay, that's a good question. What do you guys think? Were you at full time? He was. In case people didn't hear, the question was, when did he become this priest? Yeah. And when was he declared the Son of God? Acts 13 says that it was when he was resurrected. And that's where he's ever living to make intercession, and that's when he's gone into the veil. And Hebrews chapters 2 and 4 has made the point that he had to be perfected as the priest. So I think the idea is that he had to go through what he had to go through in order to be perfected in that role. So when he was living on earth and he hadn't been sacrificed, was he this great high priest at that moment? And I'm not sure that I can say yes about that. Because his role needed to be perfected in that way by going through what he went through. Yes. Yeah, we're not... So if you look at Hebrews chapter 2, go back to Hebrews 2. And look at verse 14. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil. All right. Did he have to die in order to destroy death so he could be resurrected? Yeah. So, like, and there's other passages here that talk about how he had to be perfected. Like, look at chapter 5, verse 9. Let's start in verse 8, actually. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So verse 10 says that's basically when he became the priest, or that has something to do about the timing of it. So was Jesus always perfect? Yes. But did he have to do certain things before he could have that position? And I think the answer to that question is yes. He was declared to be the Son of God. But he was always the Son of God. Right. Sure. Right. Right, and yeah, and clearly we would all agree that he had to die and raise from the dead for his work to be accomplished and to be fulfilled. And I think through all of that is when he can assume the role as priest, as he's ever living to make intercession in the presence of God and stuff like that. So I think he had to go through that suffering in order for that work to be done. Yeah. Right, yeah, so the question then is, when was his work accomplished? Right, right. And I think that's the idea. Yeah. So, yeah, Vera? Right, it was perfecting his role. He was accomplishing his role as he was going through all these things. Yeah, I think is the idea. All right. So on Sunday morning, we're going to talk about chapter 8 and the promises of the new covenant. One of the things that I want us to discuss on Sunday morning is what particularly is different about the new covenant that makes it so much better than the old covenant. In other words, how can we learn to appreciate more and be more thankful for what we have in the new covenant is a lot of what we're going to talk about on Sunday morning. So thanks, guys.